Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is being recorded at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 20th of December. Donald Trump is to appeal to the US Supreme Court after he was disqualified from the Republican presidential primary in Colorado. The leader of Hamas holds talks in Egypt as calls grow for another pause in the fighting in Gaza. And the new Polish government dismisses the state media authorities, which critics said had been an outlet for propaganda under the previous administration. Also in the podcast, a former US Marine detained in Russia tells the BBC he's been abandoned by his own country.
I know that the US has come up with all sorts of proposals, serious proposals, but it's not what the Russians are after. So they keep going back and forth. The only problem is, it's my life that's draining away.
And the 8-year-old girl who beat a chess master 30 years her senior. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the US Constitution bars anyone engaged in insurrection or rebellion from holding office. The Colorado Supreme Court has ruled by a margin of 4-3 that rule should apply to Donald Trump over the storming of the US Capitol by his supporters, and so it has disqualified him from the state's Republican primary next year. The former US president has rejected the decision, and the issue looks set to be decided by the US Supreme Court, including three justices that he appointed. I asked our Washington correspondent Nomia Iqbal if the Colorado ruling could affect Donald Trump's chances of getting the Republican nomination and ultimately of becoming president again.
Not really, because Colorado is a state that Donald Trump doesn't need to win. It's gone Democratic for many years now. He lost it in 2020. He can afford to lose it again. But I think the bigger issue here is, what if the decision is upheld by the US Supreme Court? Other states that Donald Trump does need to prevail in, does need to win, could eye up this ruling, and they could be inspired by it or emboldened by it, even though they're not legally bound by it. So that's the issue here. And we won't know which way it will go until the US Supreme Court decides at some point. As of right now, though, Donald Trump's name is still on the ballot in Colorado. That will remain as this goes through the courts, as the US Supreme Court takes it on board.
Yeah, it's just one of a number of cases regarding Donald Trump that the Supreme Court has been asked to look at. I mean, is this a legal or is it a political issue? And what do voters think of it all?
There are so many trials and issues that, you know, next year honestly, if I could show you our calendar in the newsroom, we've got all the primary dates on there. Of course, we know that. But so much of it is taken up by trials and all the different dates that we'll have to mark when that happens. In terms of, is it political, legal? I think it's both. Definitely political. There are many lawsuits that have been filed in about 12 states trying to get Donald Trump kicked off the ballot, arguing he's unfit because of what happened on January the 6th. Remember, he's not gone on trial for that, let alone be convicted. All those lawsuits have been dismissed, but it's stuck in Colorado. And if they do uphold the ruling, let's say there's the US Supreme Court decides we're going to uphold the ruling, it's going to be controversial because it means that the highest court in the land has decided that Donald Trump did engage in an insurrection and shouldn't be president. But here's the thing, if they rule against it, then voters and advocacy groups that don't want Donald Trump to run will say, well, the Supreme Court, as you mentioned there, three of its appointees are of Donald Trump's, have got involved in the election, that they've interfered. So it's just another really consequential moment that's going to play out as we head into the election next year, an election that we already knew was hugely unpredictable.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington. Officials in Gaza say more Palestinians have been dying in fighting between Israel and Hamas, with reports of multiple casualties from a bombardment near a hospital in the city of Rafah, near the Egyptian border. However, political leaders on both sides are said to be working towards a possible new ceasefire and hostage deal. The head of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, has travelled from Qatar to Egypt for talks, while the Israeli president on Tuesday spoke of being ready for another humanitarian pause. An agreement in November saw Hamas release 80 Israeli hostages in return for 240 Palestinian prisoners. Our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nell is in Jerusalem, so is another swap deal moving closer?
It does look like things are going in that direction. It will require some change on the part of the public position of Hamas, because up to now it has said that it will only accept to release more of the 100-plus Israeli hostages it's holding in exchange for a permanent ceasefire. But it's being read very much that having Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas, in Cairo — Egypt, of course, is a key mediator, he's meeting the Egyptian intelligence chief who usually holds the Gaza file — that is a sign of seriousness. There are reports in the Israeli media about a bit more on the specifics of what is potentially being discussed. They say that perhaps 30 to 40 hostages could be released over the course of a week or two, that these would be the remaining women hostages that are held, as well as older men and men who are sick or in need of urgent medical care. And in exchange, they accept, according to these reports, that some Palestinians who are held in Israeli jails and convicted of serious offences against Israelis could be among those freed in exchange, as well as, of course, another increase in the amount of aid that's going into Gaza.
And can you tell us what is known about what is actually happening in Gaza at the moment? There's reports of a big aid convoy going in, but also these claims of an attack near the Kuwaiti hospital in Rafah.
These claims are only just kind of coming through in the last period of about the attack in Rafah. I've been speaking to people in Khan Yunis in the last few hours, and they've been telling me that the fierce fighting there — this is the other southern city really at the heart of Israel's southern offensive — that fighting has been going on all through the night. It's ongoing. One man who'd moved from his neighbourhood to the Nasser hospital there for shelter said there had been violent shelling and clashes. He said Israeli tanks were noticeably moving closer to the hospital, and that is making the route to the hospital very dangerous. We heard that from a doctor there as well, and he was saying, just listing really the airstrikes that had taken place since last night, killing 15 members of one family, 10 injured in another attack. Then he talked about a number of other people who had been killed from two other families in the west of the city, and just how it was such dire conditions in the hospital. He said patients had been dying when they tried to perform surgeries because of the lack of medical supplies. There's very little anaesthetic. They've run out of blood. And because the phone communications are so poor, sometimes they just want to summon another doctor from a different part of the hospital, and it's very difficult to do even that.
Yoland, now in Jerusalem. Migration has been a contentious political issue across Europe ever since the crisis of 2015, when 1 million people arrived in the EU. This year, numbers are once again on the rise, with the border agency Frontex recording a 17% increase in what it calls irregular crossings, with more than 350,000 of them being recorded in the first 11 months of 2023. Today, after years of trying, EU member states and the European Parliament finally agreed a new plan to tackle asylum and migration. Here's the President of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola.
We can really be proud of Europe today. The agreement before the end of this year is a huge success for the constructive pro-European centre. Ahead of an election year in Europe, we had promised it to our citizens, and now we are delivering. It all comes down to Europe taking the lead, and we do it our way. We do it responsibly by addressing topics that are important for our people.
The agreement was welcomed by frontline states like Greece and Italy, which said it no longer felt alone. Hungary, though, rejected it in the strongest possible terms. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, told us about the deal.
It's a framework including a number of legislative packages, Ollie. It concerns things like, for example, the screening of irregular arrivals at the external borders of the EU to make sure it's standardised and to speed it up. This is both for things like health checks, but also for security identity checks. It provides for a biometric database, so that will stop the phenomenon of asylum shopping, whereby multiple asylum claims are lodged in different countries. It will try to speed up the processing of asylum claims. They're streamlining them, for example, from countries where people generally don't get asylum. Most asylum claims are refused. Those will be speeded up, as will the returns of migrants deemed not eligible for refugee status. And there is a crucial element to this, which is this solidarity mechanism. Frontline states have long complained that under the current rules, they have to deal with all of the migrants themselves, and they're not helped out by the other 27 member states. Now, countries will have to either accept quotas of migrants to relocate them, or they would have to make financial or material contributions to the states that do. So that's a very important breakthrough.
Yeah, I mean, will it be passed by governments who have perhaps been reluctant to accept arrivals from other countries and end those divisions between the north and south of Europe?
Well, the deal needs formal ratification both by the European Parliament and by the European Council, which represent all 27 member states. But on the basis of this agreement, it will get that ratification next year and be implemented. So the options that these countries have, they don't have to accept migrants. There have been disputes in places like Poland and Hungary where they say they don't want Muslim migrants, for example, from countries like Syria. So this has been diffused to an extent. It's still a controversial deal. Several humanitarian charities have opposed it and say that it doesn't fully protect the rights of those who arrive, especially those who are returned in speedy processes. But the European Commission and others say that all migrant arrivals will now get free legal consultation at the point of arrival, which they say is an improved right. And they say it's a fair deal that it respects the EU's humanitarian values.
Danny Eberhard, our Europe regional editor. Poland's new pro-EU coalition government has fired the heads of the country's public broadcasters as it moves to depoliticise the state media. The culture minister said new management boards had been appointed for Polish TV, radio and the state news agency. Critics said that the state-run media, in particular the 24-hour news channel TVP Info, had become an outlet for propaganda during the Law and Justice Party's 8 years in office. Their MPs, now in opposition, have begun a sit-in in a protest at Polish TV's headquarters. Here's Adam Easton in Warsaw.
The culture minister said the sackings were justified because the Polish parliament approved on Tuesday a resolution calling for an independent state media. Under the Law and Justice government, Poland dropped nearly 40 places in the World Press Freedom Index. In response to the dismissals, Law and Justice MP said the government is illegally taking control of the public media and trampling on democracy. They argue Polish TV must remain a conservative media voice, and a group of its MPs are holding a sit-in protest at the broadcaster's headquarters.
Adam Easton in Warsaw. A former American Marine jailed in Russia has told the BBC he feels betrayed and abandoned by the US government. Paul Whelan, who also has Canadian, British and Irish citizenship, was detained on espionage charges while on holiday in Moscow in 2018. President Putin said last week that the Kremlin hoped to find a solution to the dispute over detained American citizens, who include the Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford has been following their cases.
How are you doing,
Paul?
Are you
okay? How are you?
You're right.
It is 5 years since I first saw Paul Whelan being led into a Moscow court by armed guards in balaclavas.
How do you feel about this charge of spying?
They don't want us to say anything.
All negotiations to free him have failed. So when we spoke from his remote Russian labour camp...
Hey, Sarah, how are you?
Hi, Paul, how are you?
He told me he felt abandoned by his government.
It's serious betrayal. Promises have been made and broken, and I can't believe anything that I'm told now. I know that the U.S. has come up with all sorts of proposals, serious proposals, but it's not what the Russians are after. So they keep going back and forth. The only problem is, it's my life that's draining away. Why will he do this?
The U.S. State Department told me it has made multiple proposals for him to Moscow and that it's working hard. But it seems like Russia is collecting hostages now.
Evan.
Evan Gershkovich was detained in March, accused of espionage, for doing his job as a journalist. Every so often, the young American reporter appears for a custody hearing in a cage. The Wall Street Journal and his government are clear that the charge is false.
Dear Evan, I didn't take my laptop with me to New York, so I'm writing to you by hand this time.
Paulina writes to Evan every week. The two started out as reporters together in Moscow. Now he's locked up and she has to cover Russia from abroad for safety. Paulina and friends are collecting letters of support for Evan from all over the world. Paulina says what's happening is terrifying.
Yeah, when it happens to your friend, it's just the universe collapses. Evan is not a spy. Evan is a journalist. Well, my greatest hope is that Evan is released as soon as possible and can go home, can go back to work, can go back to his family.
What will it take to bring them home? And do you think that...
Vladimir Putin was asked about the American prisoners last week at a press conference. He feigned ignorance first. Then he said Moscow was open to their release, so long as a deal was mutually acceptable. But we think the only trade Moscow is demanding right now is for an FSB hitman convicted of murder in Germany. And that is deliberately difficult.
Today it's, minus 15 out, and there's no heat in the barracks.
Paul Whelan has given up hoping for a quick release.
I am worried that there'll be a deal that'll leave me here. With each case, my case is going to the back of the line. It's being left in the dust.
It is Russia that caused this. It's Russia that's playing tough. But Paul Whelan says his life has been ruined in prison, and he wants America to push harder to get him out.
Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reporting. Bonobos and chimps have the longest long-term memories ever found in animals. Researchers say the apes are capable of remembering those they've met even decades later. The recognition appears to be influenced by how well they got on with each other. Dr. Laura Lewis from the University of California, Berkeley, told Davina Gupta more about her research.
We studied chimpanzees and bonobos, their long-term social memory, meaning their years-long memory for previous group mates that they had lived with that had either died or left the group some years ago. To briefly explain, we showed the chimps and bonobos in our study who lived in zoos around the world. We showed them images on a computer screen side by side. So one was an image of their former groupmate and next to an image of a complete stranger. And using non-invasive eye tracking technology, we were able to tell that they looked longer, significantly longer, at the images of their former groupmates as compared to the images of the strangers. Mm. There were a few kind of very memorable things about these results. One is just how long their memory lasts. So in our main data set, we found that they remembered individuals or looked significantly longer at individuals that they hadn't seen going back a decade. And then in our more full data set, we even had one bonobo, Louise, who hadn't seen her sister, Loretta, or her nephew, Aaron, for over 26 years. Because there were only a few trials from Louise, we couldn't fully analyze them. But we also found much longer looking from Louise at the images of her sister.
And compare it with human memory, then. Is it coming close to it?
That's exactly right. Yes, it does actually rival our human memory. As humans, we can remember others for at least 30 years, if not more like 48 years. And so this chimpanzee and bonobo memory rivals that. It comes close to that 30-year memory.
What's the significance of this research then?
I think there's one more fascinating piece of this that I think will help us as humans, which is that we also found that apes' social memories seem to shape their long-term memory. So their social relationships with others, specifically their positive social relationships, we found that they looked longer at the images of their former friends. And I think this helps us as humans to think about our own memory, how it's shaped by our social relationships, right? And also to hopefully have more compassion for these animals and empathy and they are incredibly endangered, right? So yes. Their environments are being destroyed at astronomical rates.
Yes.
And we now know that they likely remember events in which they are endangered.
Dr. Laura Lewis talking to Davina Gupta. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
Mr. Simpson, is it true that at one point your sister-in-law was engaged to Troy McClure?
Two superfans of The Simpsons pay tribute by making their own episode. Voting is underway in the Democratic Republic of Congo in an election marred by delays, allegations of a lack of transparency and conflict in the East. President Felix Tshisekedi is seeking a second five-year term and is favourite to win against 18 challengers. Parliamentary, provincial and municipal elections are also taking place with 100,000 candidates in the running. But the campaign has been overshadowed by that fighting in eastern Congo, as I heard from our correspondent Emery Makumeno, who told me first about the problems at the polling stations today.
Yes, delays here in Kinshasa, the capital, where some people have just started voting after 2 or 3 hours delay. This is particularly at Ecole Reverend Kim, where voting started with a delay of 2 hours. The same delay reports have also been heard from in eastern cities of Goma, Bunia, and also Lubumbashi, where voting also had some delays in town. But the Electoral Commission said that they gave priority to the remote areas where 2 months ago they had started deploying because of lack of infrastructure. So in the big cities, they were going to deploy electoral material on the eve of the election and even including the voting days.
Yeah, you mentioned voting in the East. How is that affected by the conflict there?
Well, because of the conflict and particularly fresh fighting since October, 500,000 people have been obliged to flee their homes. So those are the people who had registered but might not be voting because they left their constituencies, but also two constituencies in the North Kivu province where the government and the pro-government troops are fighting a rebel group called the M23. There are two constituencies, Masisi and Ruchuru, where even registration was impossible. So there was no way for the Electoral Commission to deploy the electoral kits there. So it poses a problem of inclusivity there. But because of the fighting, voting there was made impossible.
And looking at the presidential election, what are the main issues? Even President Tshisekedi himself says his record is mixed.
Yes, so President Tshisekedi is one of his manifestos was to restore peace in the eastern conflict-torn region, where currently we have 7 million internally displaced because of the ongoing flooding for the last two decades. But, as he is at the end of his first term, the fighting is still there, the displacement is still happening. So this is something that he has not delivered. But also the rate of employment, 25 million are food insecure. These are huge issues that during the first term he has not managed to solve completely.
Emery Makumeno in Kinshasa. Staying in Africa, and officials in Sudan are warning that the health system there is collapsing. An aide in the previous civilian government said the capture of the city of Wad Madani by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces had disrupted Sudan's vaccination program. Amjad Ataib told the BBC that millions of children would be affected.
The biggest catastrophe is the displacement of the supply chain of vaccines that was destroyed by the militia in Khartoum. Now the occupation of Wad Madani by the RSF is risking the vaccination of over 2 million children under the age of 1 with the routine vaccine and over 15 million children who were planned to be vaccinated against measles in the coming few weeks.
Mr. Atayib also said the soldiers were not allowing the population to leave and they were, in effect, being held hostage. Wad Madani had been a safe haven for hundreds of thousands of people who'd fled the fighting in the capital, Khartoum. Hala Al-Karib, a Sudanese women's rights activist based in Uganda, told James Copnell what she'd been hearing about conditions in Wad Madani.
Very scary what I'm hearing from Wad Madani. It's exactly a recycling of what has happened in West Darfur and what has happened in Niala and in Zalenji and earlier in April in Khartoum. You know, the RSF is taking over the cities. They are going door to door. There is reports of looting, of course, but what's more dangerous, there is reports of, you know, atrocities, civilians, executions and sexual violence. And, you know, we are still, you know, hearing, you know, every day of new, not every day, actually, every hour, you know, of new incidents of atrocities. So it's extremely, extremely scary and worrying, you know, with the scale of the conflict expanding.
When you say atrocities, and I'm aware that some of the details will be private, but also maybe very shocking to people, but could you perhaps give us an example or two of things you've been hearing?
This is exactly what happened in Jenina, and it happened in Khartoum and other cities. You know, is initially when the RSF are entering the city, they enter with the idea of conquering, you know, and the fact that everything is theirs. So people's properties, but women and girls, they've looked at as also, you know, properties. And so this is the time when sexual violence occurs inside people's homes. So women are raped inside their homes by the soldiers. And it's a known tactic that the RSF or the Janjaweed have been using for very, very long time, and it didn't change. It's an ongoing pattern. It's a war strategy of terror and of, you know, domination.
Hala Al-Kharib, a Sudanese women's rights activist, talking to James Copnell. In 2021, the president of Haiti, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated, plunging the Caribbean nation into chaos and worsening the violence and political instability. Now, a court in the US has sentenced a former Haitian senator to life in prison for his role in the affair. John Joel Joseph admitted helping to plan the murder. Will Grant reports.
The life sentence handed down to a former Haitian senator, John Joel Joseph, shows just how high up the plot to murder President Jovenel Moïse went. It is alleged that the killing was carried out in President Moïse's residence in Port-au-Prince by a group of Colombian mercenaries. However, Mr. Joseph pleaded guilty to his part in the conspiracy and admitted to taking part in planning the ambush. Specifically, he said he had attended meetings where President Moïse's assassination was discussed, including on the night before the murder. He also provided material support for the group which allegedly carried out the shooting by providing them with rental vehicles and attempting to obtain weapons for them. Former Senator Joseph now becomes the third of 11 defendants to plead guilty over the murder, with former Colombian army officers and foreign businessmen among those charged in the case. Since the murder, Haiti has been plunged into many months of a political vacuum, with elections repeatedly stalled or cancelled and a sharp rise in violence by powerful street gangs.
Will Grant reporting. Competitive chess, with its need for a sharp and creative mind, has been called a young person's game. But a rising star from London is testing the limits of exactly how young, winning prizes at international tournaments at the age of just 8. Peter Goffin has the story.
Badana Sivanathan found her calling at 5 years old as the world was locking down during the COVID pandemic.
When one of my dad's friends was going back to India in COVID time, he gave us a chessboard. I was interested in the pieces and I started playing.
3 years later, she's been named the top female player at the European Championships for Blitz and Rapid Chess. Time-limited matches that test a player's quick reactions. To win that title, she beat Lauren DaCosta, the 39-year-old coach of England's national women's team. In the tournament's final round, she played to a draw with the 54-year-old Romanian grandmaster Vladislav Nevednici.
I always try my best to win all the tournaments, all the games. Sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. I just play the board.
Chess is no stranger to child prodigies. The legendary American grandmaster Bobby Fischer won his first national championship at 14. The Indian player Ramesh Babu Pragnananda was ranked an international master at age 10. 2 years ago, aged 16, he beat world champion Magnus Carlsen. That's the path Badana dreams of. Grandmaster status, gold medals, and global titles. She's competed across Britain, in Croatia, Egypt, and beyond, with her dad, Siva, in tow.
She likes it, and she likes traveling as well, so I keep taking her to tournaments. Like she said, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work well, but we keep trying and keep going.
The president of the English Chess Federation has called Badana a phenomenon, her playing style remarkably mature, strategic, and patient. Chess may be contained to 64 squares on a board, but for Badano, the world is opening up before her.
Peter Goffin. Finally, have a listen to this.
May I remind you that this is a court case, not open mic night at the Comedy Loft?
It's not! Oh, you lied to me, Wickham.
Hey, it was the only way to get you to show up for jury duty.
Oh, whatever. As long as there's good material I can reuse later.
Now, if you're a fan of The Simpsons, you might think that is from a new episode. But it's actually the work of two superfans, American voice actor Jaden LeBron and New Zealand-based animator Andrew Kempel. They've written, animated and voiced a 7-minute pastiche of an early Simpsons episode, which has even made its way to Simpsons showrunners and writers who've called it amazing. The BBC's Will Chalk has been talking to them.
Hi, I'm Andrew Kempel. I'm an animator and I made a fan animation about The Simpsons recently.
Hi, I'm Jaden LeBron. I'm a voice actor from Southern California.
This is 7 minutes long, this video, and you play every single character.
Yeah, that I do.
Mr. Simpson, is it true that at one point your sister-in-law was engaged to Troy McClure?
Hey!
How did you two meet?
We were both on the same Simpsons meme groups on Facebook, and I think Jaden had seen a few of my memes and I'd heard a few of his impressions. And
it's Romeo and Juliet for the modern age, isn't it?
Yeah, basically.
The animation alone it's incredible. You do this for your job, right? But how much time did you put aside to dedicate to this hobby?
Well, usually in the evenings or weekends when I could find time after work, I'd do that. And it took a lot longer than I thought.
You've had an amazing response from Simpsons workers. You've sent this to writers and showrunners.
Yes, Al Jean, Mike Reese, recently sent it to Bill Oakley. One of the concerns that I've had in the days leading up to it was whether or not they'd see this as a respectful interpretation of the characters that they've all written for. And it's incredibly gratifying to know that the characters sound good, that they were written well.
Yeah, and especially because like my sense of humor as an animator comes a lot from The Simpsons that I was watching back when I was little. So, you know, it's fun to sort of, you know, express how I've been influenced by them and they actually see it. That's quite surreal to hear about.
Well, thank you guys very much for your time. Jaden, I think it's going to go over to you to sign us off in any impressionistic way you feel appropriate.
Well, all I'll say, Will, is I wish you a very merry sobriety and a happy stupid Flanders.
Jaden LeBron and Andrew Kempel talking to Will Chalk. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and mixed by Johnny Baker. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.